Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine spending 32 years building the most intricate, sprawling, just unimaginably detailed domino structure in the entire world.
Right.
Like, you meticulously place millions of individual pieces. You paint every single one by hand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you write these elaborate, century-spanning backstories for the tiny fictional people living inside these domino houses. You build this massive, passionate audience of millions who are, cheering you on.
They're buying your dominoes, translating the stories into dozens of languages.
Exactly. And then, while everyone is watching, you just deliberately, permanently knock the entire thing over.
And just completely shatter it.
Just shatter it into pieces,
Yeah.
and you just walk away.
I mean, it sounds like an act of absolute artistic madness, or, depending on how you look at it, a masterstroke of commercial sabotage.
It sounds completely unhinged, but
Yeah.
that is exactly what we are looking at in today's deep dive. We have this massive stack of sources on the docket today: retrospective essays, these huge hardcover rule books from the 1980s, creator interviews, gaming history articles.
It's a lot of material.
It is. And it's all focused on a fictional universe that its creators spent over 3 decades building, only to intentionally destroy it. We're talking about the Warhammer fantasy setting.
Specifically, the tabletop gaming universe known as the Old World, or as its grieving fans now call it, the world that was.
Right. So our mission today, for you, the listener, is to explore what made this setting so profoundly unique compared to standard fantasy, how its incredibly detailed lore actually functioned, and why on earth a successful company would literally blow up its own beloved intellectual property.
And it's crucial to state up front that our mission today isn't just to recount some fictional history for you. By looking at these creator interviews and rule books, we are going to examine what is genuinely a masterclass in world building.
Totally.
Because to understand why anyone, anywhere would mourn a fictional planet, you have to understand its fundamental architecture. This was a world that was designed from day one to be losing.
Which is such a wild concept for a fantasy setting. Usually, you build a world so your heroes can save it. But before we get to the literal apocalypse, let's establish what actually got destroyed here. We need to look at the geography of this place.
Right, the map.
Because, as these essays point out, the map itself is almost a dark joke that sets up everything else.
Yeah, if you look at a map of the Old World, lead designer Rick Priestley and his team basically took a 16th century map of Europe and, well, they barely filed off the serial numbers.
It really is just Europe.
It is Europe in all its early modern gunpowder and plague glory. You have the Empire, which is the central human nation of the setting, this squabbling, sprawling patchwork of feuding provinces ruled by an elected emperor. It is undeniably the Holy Roman Empire wearing a fake mustache.
I love that description so
Yeah.
much. But wait, why do it that way? Was it just a shortcut, or was there a specific design philosophy behind ripping off real-world geography?
It was actually incredibly deliberate, and it had everything to do with the fact that this was a tabletop miniature game.
Okay.
If you are asking hobbyists to assemble and paint hundreds of tiny metal or plastic soldiers, giving them familiar historical touchstones makes the world instantly accessible.
That makes total sense.
You don't have to explain the complex political structure of a totally alien society. You just say, hey, they look like 16th century German mercenaries.
And the player immediately knows how to paint them. They know what their vibe is. You ground the visuals in reality so the fantasy elements hit harder.
Yeah.
And the map doesn't stop at Germany, right?
Not at all. Look to the west and you find Britonia. This is a land of heavily armored knights, peasant serfs, holy grail quests. It's essentially Arthurian France.
Right.
To the north and east, there's Kislev, a freezing, brutal realm of horse archers and onion dome cities. That's your analog for Russia.
Oh, wow.
You've got Tilea, mirroring Italy with its coast of merchant city states and mercenary companies. Astalia stands in for Spain, full of proud duelists. Norska, home to relentless fjord-dwelling raiders, is Scandinavia.
And if you go far to the east, past the mountains, you find Cathay, representing China, and Nippon, representing Japan.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. It's like reading a medieval history textbook, right? You're reading about all the superstitious paranoia that actual real-world medieval Europeans had. Like,
Yes.
they thought the old woman in the woods was doing something terrible. They thought the bubonic plague was a curse sent by a malevolent cosmic force. And the brilliant trap of this setting is that it takes all of those historical medieval fears and says to you they're entirely real.
It physically manifests humanity's worst nightmares.
Yes. In the old world, the witch is channeling literal monsters. The plague is actually sent by a dark god who wants you to rot.
The setting pulls a bait and switch. You arrive thinking you know the rules, that this is just a standard historical fantasy, maybe a little gritty, and then the jaws of the trap snap shut.
I love that.
This tone is crucial. When the companion game Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay was released in 1986, it essentially invented the genre we now refer to as grimdark.
Right, because in a normal fantasy role-playing game, like Dungeons & Dragons, you usually play the glorious hero. You're the chosen one with the glowing sword destined to slay the dragon.
Main character.
Exactly. But these old source books paint a completely different picture. You aren't playing a prince. You're playing a rat catcher.
Or a gravedigger.
Or maybe a road warden patrolling a miserable swamp where the bandits outnumber the actual travelers. Mm. You aren't playing to save the world. You're just trying to survive the mud.
Survival was the win condition. Glory was for people who hadn't been paying attention to how dangerous the world actually was. The mud, the disease, the constant threat of starvation. Those were just the baseline challenges before the actual monsters showed up.
Well, if the baseline reality is this terrible, if you're just a rat catcher trying not to get eaten by a forest monster, how did the world get this way? Because it wasn't always a grim, dark nightmare, right? The sources talk about a time before humanity even existed.
Yeah, to understand why the old world is relentlessly besieged, you have to look at the top of the world. At the North and South Poles, reality itself has a physical wound.
A literal hole in the sky.
Exactly. Long before humanity or elves existed, this planet, which the deep lore refers to as Malice, was the workshop for godlike alien beings called the Old Ones.
Like actual space aliens.
Basically, yeah. These Old Ones arrived from somewhere else entirely. They played God. They reshaped the planet, they nudged it closer to its sun to warm it up, and they engineered the first thinking races to act as their servants and caretakers.
Wow.
And to travel across the stars, they built these massive warp gates at the North and South Poles. They were doorways stitched into the fabric of the universe.
And then the doorways broke.
They catastrophically collapsed. This event is remembered in the lore as the Great Catastrophe, happening roughly 56 centuries before the setting's present day.
So what happened when they broke?
Well, what poured out of those broken gates wasn't a conventional invading army with swords and shields. It was chaos.
Capital C, chaos.
Yes. This is raw, unfiltered magic and malevolence pouring in from a parallel dimension. It's the literal stuff that dreams and nightmares are made of, but it has a malicious, sentient will behind it. The Old Ones vanished entirely, and the land around those broken gates curdled into what are called the Chaos Wastes.
Which sounds lovely.
Oh, it's terrible. These endless hallucinatory badlands where the laws of physics are just a suggestion. Gravity might work sideways. The ground might scream at you. It is pure nightmare logic.
Wait, let me stop you right there. If this raw, malignant chaos energy is just pouring in constantly from a broken gate at the top of the world, how does anything survive at all?
Yeah.
Isn't this just a permanent feature of the cosmos you can't defeat?
Yeah.
Like, how do you fight a hole in reality?
You're assuming the universe wants them to survive. It doesn't. You can't fight it, not permanently. The threat of chaos is a structural feature of this cosmos. The best anyone can do is hold the line, and that line is always slowly, inevitably losing ground. The Great Catastrophe left horrific physical scars on the world. It flung something called warp stone across the entire planet.
Which is solidified chaos, right?
Exactly that. It's physical magic that violently mutates anything it touches. If a human touches enough warp stone, they don't just get sick. They literally stop being human.
That is so creepy.
The lore explains that the Beastmen, these horrific goat-headed creatures that haunt every deep forest in the Empire, are the result of early humans mutating from this chaos influence. They are a constant lurking threat in the woods.
And it's not just the woods, right? The sky is messed up, too.
Yeah. The world even has a second moon made entirely of this stuff. There is the same steady white moon called Manslabe, but then there is a colossal chunk of warp stone hanging in orbit called Morslabe.
A giant rock of pure nightmare.
Yeah, it's a sickly green moon that waxes and wanes unpredictably. When the green moon is full, terrible things stir. Morslabe dictates the calendar of chaos.
So if chaos is this overwhelming mutating force, does that mean human wizards are just tapping into that same destructive energy? How do they not instantly turn into goat monsters every time they cast a spell?
What's fascinating here is how the setting handles magic as a mechanic. It serves as a kind of pressure valve for this apocalyptic energy, because in the old world, magic is weather.
I love this concept. So if chaos splits like a prism, does that mean human wizards are only getting a diluted version of the magic?
That's a great way to put it. As the raw chaos energy bleeds south from the Polar Rift, it doesn't stay as one unified destructive force. As it drifts over the world, it separates exactly the way white light splits when it hits a prism. It splinters into 8 distinct currents, which are known as the winds of magic.
And each wind has its own flavor, its own identity. You've got Akshi, the red wind of fire and passion, Azir, the blue wind of the heavens and prophecy, Chamon, the yellow wind of metal and alchemy, Giran, the green wind of life, Shaiish, the purple wind of death.
Right, and a human wizard cannot wield raw chaos. It would burn their mind out in seconds or mutate them into a monster.
So they specialize.
Exactly. What they can do is learn to ride just one of those single winds. A bright wizard spends their entire life learning to safely channel the red wind of fire. An amethyst wizard trains to channel the purple wind of death.
This is so important for you to understand if you're picturing a generic fantasy game. In this world, magic isn't some generic video game mana bar that you just deplete and then drink a blue potion to refill.
No, not at all.
It is incredibly dangerous. When a human wizard casts a spell, they are literally taking a calculated breath of chaos itself. It's like trying to harness a hurricane with a kite. If you lose focus for a second, the kite pulls you into the storm.
And even with those wizards acting as minor pressure valves, the world would still drown in this energy if it weren't for some ancient cosmic housekeeping.
Housekeeping, like dusting and sweeping.
That's essentially what it is. The world only survives because 2 ancient non-human races are tirelessly bailing water against the tide. On the island continent of Ulthuan, the high elves maintain something called the Great Vortex.
Okay, what does that do?
It's a vast magical whirlpool that continuously sucks excess chaos out of the world, acting like a giant cosmic drain to prevent a second catastrophe.
Wow.
Meanwhile, down in the steaming southern jungles, the lizard men, who are the direct descendants of the Old One's original servants, are still executing this ancient great plan.
Just following orders.
Yeah, they operate with cold, reptilian patience, following instructions on golden plaques from gods that vanished 5,000 years ago. The world is held together by these housekeepers. If they stop sweeping, chaos fills the room.
Okay, so if the elves and the lizard men are stuck playing cosmic janitors, humanity is completely unprotected on the ground. How did squabbling tribes survive long enough to build this massive Holy Roman Empire knockoff?
They needed a champion.
Which means we need to talk about the central human figure of this entire universe, the man who became a god. Let's talk about Sigmar.
And Sigmar's story is fascinating because it starts out feeling like a very traditional heroic fantasy trope, but it gets twisted by the grim reality of the setting.
Right. So you go back about 3,000 years before the setting's present day. Humanity isn't an empire yet. It's just a dozen scattered, warring tribes dressed in animal skins. A chieftain's son named Sigmar is born, and on the night of his birth, a twin-tailed comet streaks across the sky.
A classic omen.
Totally. That comet becomes his emblem forever.
But he doesn't just unite them through diplomacy. He is a brutal warlord who realizes that if humanity doesn't stand together, they will be wiped out by the monsters in the dark.
Exactly. As a young warrior, Sigmar saves a dwarf high king from a massive orc ambush. The dwarfs, who in this setting are these proud, grudge-keeping master smiths of the mountains, are so grateful that they gift Sigmar a legendary runic warhammer.
The ultimate weapon.
Yeah, the hammer is called Galmaraz, which translates to skull splitter. It's the weapon that actually gives the entire Warhammer franchise its name.
It's the physical anchor of the lore.
So with this hammer, Sigmar does the impossible. He forges a permanent alliance between humans and dwarves, and he violently unites those 12 quarreling human tribes. They face down a massive invasion of greenskins, orcs, and goblins pouring out of the mountains at a place called the First Battle of Blackfire Pass.
A massive turning point.
Yeah, Sigmar crushes them. It's the founding military miracle of human civilization. He gets crowned the first emperor, establishes the calendar, and then 50 years later, he just vanishes.
Poof, gone.
He walks east into the mountains, returning the hammer to the dwarfs, and is never seen again.
And the grand irony is that the man who built an empire of mud and steel is eventually deified by the very people he left behind.
Yes. Centuries later, the empire worships him. He joins a crowded polytheistic pantheon. He sits right alongside older gods like Ulrich, the wolf god of winter and war, and Tal, the god of beasts. But Sigmar is the heart of it all.
Which is vital when you contrast Sigmar's fragile, hard-won order with the ultimate antagonists of the setting. If Sigmar is the promise that order is worth dying for, the four Chaos Gods are the setting's death sentence.
Right.
And these gods are not abstract metaphors. They are real, sentient powers dwelling in the parallel dimension of the warp, and each one is sustained by a specific emotion that mortals cannot help but feel.
So break these four down for us, because their domains are really unsettling.
First, you have Khorne. Khorne is the god of rage and bloodshed. Every single murder, every fit of fury, every battle fought anywhere in the world feeds him. He sits on a throne made entirely of skulls. Then you have Nurgle, the god of decay, plague, and despair. But Nurgle is horrifying because he loves his followers with this grotesque tenderness. He gives them horrifying diseases the way a grandfather gives out candy, taking away their pain if they just embrace the rot.
Oh, that is disgusting.
Third is Cainch, the god of change, ambition, and scheming. He is the patron of anyone who has ever wanted more and plotted to get it. And finally, Slaanesh, the god of excess. Pleasure and pain taken past every limit. The god of those who never learned the word enough.
So what does this all mean? The villains are fed by human nature. If you feel hope or ambition, you feed Cainch. If you get angry at injustice and fight back, you feed Khorne.
And that is the dreadful elegance of the setting.
Yeah.
You cannot starve these gods because their food is the human condition itself. As long as mortals feel anger, hope, fear, and desire, the Chaos Gods grow fat.
That is terrifying. How do they not just instantly win? If every sword swung against them feeds their god of war, it feels like a rigged game.
The only thing keeping the world alive is something the lore calls the Great Game. The Chaos Gods actually hate each other almost as much as they hate the mortal world.
Really?
Yeah. Khorne despises Slaanesh because Khorne values martial honor while Slaanesh is just about selfish indulgence. Cainch is constantly scheming against Nurgle because Cainch represents change and Nurgle represents stagnant decay. They are locked in an eternal cosmic squabble.
So they distract each other.
Exactly. If those four ever put aside their differences and truly cooperated, the world would end in a single day.
And as if a guaranteed slow-motion cosmic apocalypse isn't enough, we haven't even really touched on the margins of this world. The sources detail so many other horrors. You've got the Skaven, for instance.
The Skaven are one of the most brilliant original creations in the lore.
Imagine an entire civilization of literally millions of treacherous, scheming rat men who worship a distinct chaos entity called the Horned Rat. But they don't live in a faraway land. They build their civilization, the Under Empire, directly beneath the human cities.
Right beneath their feet.
Yes. They are mining that radioactive warp zone we talked about and using it to build literal dirty nukes and genetic monstrosities right under the sewers of the Empire. And the human authorities just deny they exist.
It's hilarious and terrifying.
Then you've got the Tomb Kings, these reanimated Egyptian-style mummies in the southern deserts holding on to the glory of a fallen empire. You've got orcs constantly raiding the mountains, literal vampires ruling the aristocracy in a province called Sylvania, treating the human peasants as free-range blood banks. It's relentless.
It is a crucible. The world is a pressure cooker of threats. And these core ideas were so potent that the company realized they had captured lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
Just 3 years after the fantasy game launched in 1987, the creators adapted this exact formula into a science fiction setting. They took the Holy Human Empire, the Hole in Reality, and the four emotion-eating Chaos Gods, and they scaled it up to a galaxy-wide conflict. That became Warhammer 40,000.
Which is an absolute juggernaut today. It's one of the biggest sci-fi properties in the world.
It is. But it all started here, in this exquisite, doomed balance of the old world. A balance that held the line for 32 years of real-world publishing history.
32 years?
Yeah. Until in 2014, the creators decided to do the unthinkable. They let chaos win.
This is where we get to the absolute destruction of the domino structure.
They launched a massive, multi-book narrative campaign called The End Times. And it delivered on the grim promise the setting had made from the very beginning. The four Chaos Gods finally stopped squabbling.
Oh, no.
The arch-necromancer Nagash rose from the dead. The greatest human champion of Chaos, a warlord named Archaon the Ever-Chosen, united the northern tribes and led the most massive army in the world's history out of the wastes.
Just a total bloodbath.
Province by province, the old world was overrun. The Great Vortex failed. The Skaven blew up the Green Moon, raining warpstone meteors down on the planet. And then the planet was physically torn apart. Everyone died.
Everyone.
Everyone. The lore literally ends with Sigmar, the God King, clinging to the shattered core of the planet as it tumbles through the dark void.
Okay, here's the million-dollar question. I am trying to wrap my head around this from an outside perspective. Imagine if Disney suddenly declared that Star Wars was completely non-canon, blew up the entire galaxy in a final movie, killed Luke Skywalker permanently, and then just started selling a totally different type of sci-fi toy.
Right.
Why would a highly profitable company pull the plug on its own beloved property?
The honest answer requires us to look at the real-world economics of tabletop gaming. By the time the game reached its 8th edition in 2010, the rules had evolved in a way that required players to field vast, massive blocks of identical infantry. This is what's known as horde mechanics.
So you couldn't just play with a dozen cool knights?
No. It looked beautiful on a tournament table, but it was ruinous for hobbyists.
Because of the cost.
The cost and the time. If you're a new player walking into a store and someone tells you that you need to buy, assemble, and painstakingly hand-paint 100 identical state troops just to play a beginner game that is a massive barrier to entry.
I mean, who has the time for that?
Exactly. We're talking hundreds of dollars and hundreds of hours of manual labor before you ever roll a single die. Sales were lagging, veteran players already had their armies and weren't buying more, and new players couldn't afford the time or money to join. The business model was suffocating under the weight of its own rules.
So they initiated a controlled demolition of the entire intellectual property.
They destroyed the world to clear the slate. They launched a totally separate continuity called Warhammer Age of Sigmar. It wasn't just a sequel. It was a completely new high fantasy universe set across 8 infinite magic-shaped mortal realms.
So a completely different vibe.
And crucially, from a business perspective, the new game focused on small skirmishes. You could play with a handful of big, characterful heroes rather than massive blocks of ranked troops. It solved the economic problem, but it left the fans of the old lore completely devastated.
Because they had spent decades investing in a world that was just functionally deleted. But this is my favorite part of the whole story. We have to talk about the 2024 twist.
Oh, yes.
The setting refused to stay dead. Fans grieved the world that was so deeply and for so long that the company eventually realized they had made a mistake in totally abandoning it. So they brought it back.
They really did.
They released a game called Warhammer, The Old World. But it's not a sequel to The Apocalypse. It's a prequel. It's set roughly 3 centuries earlier during a chaotic period of history called the Anarchy. They brought back the doomed world just so fans could spend time in it before the end comes.
It's essentially a historical reenactment of a fictional tragedy. The players are setting up their armies knowing full well that in 300 years, the sky will rip open and everything they are fighting for will be destroyed.
Yes, and that really brings it back to you listening to this. Why does any of this matter? The old world wasn't brilliant because it offered some shiny escapist fantasy where the good guys always triumph and the hero gets a medal.
No, definitely not.
It was brilliant because it was this perfect snow globe of a doomed civilization. It was a place where fighting back, digging your heels into the mud, and holding the line, even when you know for an absolute fact that you're losing, was the whole point.
The struggle itself was the victory.
Exactly. They built that beautiful sandcastle for 32 years just to show us how bravely the little plastic soldiers would fight the tide.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it leaves us with something quite profound to consider. If a totally fictional world becomes profoundly more meaningful and beloved by its fans precisely because its total destruction is guaranteed, what does that tell us about our own real-world relationship with history, legacy, and the stories we invent to face our inevitable end?